call with Mayor. Are we on? Okay, thanks. The chair refers to the subcommittee on what subcommittee is it? The technology biotech committee. House file 1357, House file 1356, and House file 1002. I'm sorry, 1002 goes to the tourism committee. So that's all we need to do on that.
Okay.
Representative Gazelka, you want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Before we do that, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
I've got to move the bill first. Okay. So Representative Gazelka moves House File 667 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register.
Yes.
Representative Gazelka, you want to take up the A1 amendment and get it in the shape you want to talk about the bill?
Thanks, sir. Yes, I would.
Representative Gazelka moves the A1 amendment. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Gazelka, it's your bill.
Okay. Last time we met, we had a brief packet of information that I'm going to review because it's not in there, and we'll get it to you for the next meeting. But I want to give you a little bit of overview about the FAIR plan so you know what we're trying to accomplish first. The FAIR plan is it's called the Minnesota FAIR plan. It was created by the Minnesota legislature in 1968. The purpose of the FAIR plan was to provide limited property insurance when coverage was not available from the private market. So it was kind of a last resort where people could get home insurance or things of that nature when they couldn't get it out in the private market. The policies that we write, it says in the FAIR plan information, are not as desirable as those available from private insurance companies. So this is, again, a place of last resort. The FAIR plan is non-replacement and only for a limited number of causes of losses. So this is not your typical homeowners program. Or coverages like that, but it's available for people that can't get it somewhere else. As far as how you get coverage in the FAIR plan, you can obtain an application from any licensed insurance agent, or the consumer can just go out there on their own and do it. And then they fill out the application, they send it in, the FAIR plan approves it, and they get limited coverage. So just one little bit more brief history on that. As far as the FAIR plan, I mentioned it started in 1968. At that point, it was designed for the Urban Property Protection and Reinsurance Act. It was mostly focusing on urban areas, but then in 1986, it expanded statewide. So it deals with typically properties that are below average in quality around the state. I think that's about all I want to give you on that. So you get to read that next time. I've got a few more things, though. So when the FAIR plan is written, just to give you an idea then how it works, typically it goes through an agent. That insurance agent will write the FAIR plan because they cannot write home insurance with the companies that they provide for. It's sent in, and then coverage is provided. But there's a problem with how it's presently set up, and that is if that property is overinsured, the FAIR plan at this point really only has two options on a claim. The option number one is to pay the claim, pay more than they ever would have had it been insured properly, or number two, deny the claim and say there's no coverage. And so there's not really, in my opinion, enough options. And so the solution that they proposed to me was allow us to pay the proper amount of insurance. Allow us not to just have the option of paying it or denying it, but in some cases where it's way overinsured, pay the proper amount. And so, as I see it, it's better for the consumer in that in those few cases where there's losses where it was too much insurance, they don't have to just deny it or pay it. They can negotiate with them for the FAIR option. It's better for the FAIR plan because it gives them more options than just denying a claim or paying it. And for those cases where an insurance agent is involved and he made the mistake or she made the mistake, it could avoid potential liability claims because they settled before going to court. But in any of these cases, they still have the opportunity to go to court, to sue the agent, to sue the FAIR plan. So I think The FAIR Plan is the one that asked us to consider this. The Commerce Department is also in favor of this. As it is worded now, insurance agents that I've talked to are also in favor of it. So at this time, I think maybe before we have the questions, I should have Dan Johnson, the executive director of the FAIR Plan, cover anything that I missed.
Thank you very much. You did a fine job in covering.
Mr. Johnson, could you please introduce yourself for that?
My name is Daniel Johnson. I am the executive director of the Minnesota FAIR Plan. And Representative Gazelka's comments are all very accurate and display a knowledge of the plan that most people do not have. Very good job. Thank you. Part of the concern we have is that within Chapter 65A, there is a conflict in the wording. Our enabling legislation states that any licensed agent can submit an application to the FAIR Plan. This preserves the accessibility of the public to the FAIR Plan. The agent will be paid a commission to encourage them to do it. For the purpose of state law, according to our enabling legislation, this agent does not represent the FAIR Plan. As a result, the FAIR Plan would not be responsible for any actions of that agent. The agent represents the customer. The difficulty arises, though, in application of 65A08. It says that, in fact, the FAIR Plan will be responsible for the amount of coverage that the agent requested if we are unable to catch it, which we do try to do, but we can't catch them all. So what we are suggesting is to make the wording in the chapter consistent, and by appending the wording for 65-08, make it clear that the FAIR Plan is not responsible for the behavior of the agent. How we would try to accommodate a situation in case of mistake, as mentioned, if we found that the property was overinsured, we would reduce the coverage, and additional payment made by the policyholder for the excess coverage would be refunded to them. The agent would also be required to repay the FAIR Plan any commission paid on the excess amount, and we also inform the Department of Commerce of the fact that the agent has done this. This has become an acute problem lately because of what's happening in the real estate market and the insistence of mortgage companies to provide coverage for the full amount of their mortgage, even though that mortgage is often based on the value of the land, which no insurer will provide coverage for. And that's one of the reasons why this has become such a problem for us. We've even found examples where agents have doubled the value of the insurance simply to satisfy the mortgage company's demand. And fortunately, in the case we found this, it wasn't a total loss, so we were not confronted with the question of do we deny outright and let the customer go after the agent, or do we pay it? It was a partial loss, and we're very fortunate in that sense. But it brought to light the fact that this could be a real problem, and that we do not feel that it's in the best interest of the policyholder or the public to force these types of situations to go to court. I guess that's about all I can add off the top, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several questions. I discussed it last week with you for about a half hour, problems with this bill. First of all, you said you have two options, pay full or deny. There's no difference between that and non-FAIR plan, is there? I don't see any difference in the statute between what you can do if you dispute the amount and what another company non-FAIR plan can do if they don't feel that it's a full amount. Don't they have the same choice when it comes down to a claim?
No, sir.
Mr. Johnson.
They're required by the wording of 6508 to pay the coverage limit in the event of a total loss. They are not allowed to dispute the amount of coverage at that time.
Okay, so they would have to, they couldn't test it and deny it then.
They would have to pay the claim at that point. If they chose to take remedial action against their agent, that would certainly be their right to do. This is one of the things that the FAIR Plan does not have available to us. We cannot take action against agents. And, in fact, I would submit that we should not, because that will hamper the accessibility to the FAIR Plan by the public.
Representative Miller?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, then you have more options than a regular insurance company. So then the next thing, you mentioned the mortgage companies want coverage, and that's true of any plan too, whether it's FAIR Plan or private another insurance plan. And I asked you at the time to, the problem with this is that it's just a shotgun approach, blast everything. We could do a much more narrower language which would get at the problem that other insurance companies have some control over the agents, and we could grant that under law. Have you looked into possible language for that at all since we talked about a week ago?
Mr. Gatt. No, I have not, because I believe that the Department of Commerce is already in position to regulate the behavior of agents. They are, in fact, the controllers, the licenses for the agents, and they are the ones that have the power to do this. I am concerned that if we start attempting to take action against agents, even if we do have statutory wording allowing us to do it, that would have a chilling effect on agents' willingness to help people get insurance through the plan.
Representative Gazelka, to that point?
This is of the field that I'm in. I sell home insurance, and once in a while we have to write the FAIR plan. And this is true for rural. This may not be true for the inner city. I can't speak for that. But I can say that we write maybe one or two of these a year. The typical agent does not like to sell these because they're just, it's a lot of extra paperwork. We just don't do many of them, and so they're typically not that fun to write. So we'd rather not write them. Would be, you know, so if you make it more prohibitive for the agent, they would rather not do it. And secondly, what's unique about this is any other homeowner's policy, as the example we're using, is written through an agent or a company. The FAIR plan, the consumer can actually go out there and fill out the papers and get the coverage with the FAIR plan. So it's a little bit unique that way, and that's why I think we have some differences.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Another question I'd had, but you answered it, is that the burden now is on the consumer, from what you said. So the consumer would have to go to court and try to prove coverage and the amount of their claim being valid, which concerns me. Would you be willing to put in a standard of clear and convincing so that the FAIR plan has the responsibility of showing that, so that the FAIR plan is the one that has to show and prove that the amount set in the policy is wrong?
This is, would be our standard procedure. If we run into a situation where the adjuster handling the loss feels that there could be a problem with the evaluation of value at the time that the policy was issued, they, our standard procedure is for them to produce a replacement cost worksheet and then determine what the appropriate actual cash value should have been. So this is a process that we do as a normal routine.
Mr. Chairman, that's not answering the question. Would you be, because that's still leaving, you're setting a figure and then the customer has to prove that that's wrong. That's totally the opposite. You're putting the onus on this poor person who just lost their house or something. I'm asking if you would adopt and agree to adopt a clear and convincing standard that you would prove by a clear and convincing evidence your figures and that the policy is wrong. I'm looking at protecting this person that just lost their house or something.
We use the replacement cost computations that are used by the private industry. We will accept the replacement cost evaluations of the agents right now. We will be moving to a unified process that all agents must use as soon as we have it in place. This would be the system. It's called Marshall Swift Beck, and it's a private company that provides evaluation services for the insurance industry. In fact, they probably have about 75% of the insurance industry. We would use this process, that method, to determine what the value of the property was. This would not be something that would be... maybe I'm not understanding your question. I guess I'm not.
Representative Mullery?
Trying to get an answer. And maybe everybody on the commission understands. Sometimes the witnesses just don't understand a question conveniently, but maybe not. I'm not sure how to get it across. You keep saying what it is, but that still leaves a burden on the consumer. I'm asking if you would help the consumer, the person who just had their house lost, by saying that you would have the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence what your figure is, rather than the consumer having to try to overcome what you set. And
yes.
I'm very interested in yes. protecting consumers.
Yes, we would be
Mr. Johnson.
Completely willing to. I would consider us to be the ones burdened with proving what the value of the property was.
So, if, and I don't have
and
the
it's
language.
It's in our interest to do it this way, because if we are sued and we lose, then we pay that plus the cost of defending ourselves. So it is not in our interest to try to force something on the customer. That having been said, if we did reach an impasse, the contract wording does provide for something called appraisal, which is another form of dispute resolution that does not involve the courts, at which time the customer would be allowed to pick their representative, we ours, and those two representatives would pick an umpire. They would then sit down and basically, through a process of arbitration, determine what the amount should be. So if we came back with a figure that the customer said, I'm sorry, I disagree with that, my property is worth more than that, we have a provision in the contract already that would allow us to reconcile that disagreement without having to go to court.
Well, Representative Mueller.
Mr. Chairman, I would guess that the purpose of this statute was to protect the consumer from having to go out and hire a lot of people in most cases, do everything like that. We're trying to protect consumers here. My language, what I'm trying to do is protect the consumer and get you, let you have the right that you're talking about to do that. And if you would accept that language, I don't have as much problem with this. If you don't, then we're really sticking it to the consumer royally. And
my understanding,
Mr. Johnson.
I'm sorry. My understanding of 65A08 and the wording was to prevent the practice of over-insuring properties, collecting too much premium, and therefore enriching yourself as an agent by insuring it for more than it was worth. Then at the time of a loss, the adjuster would come out and say, well, wait a minute, you may have a $200,000 policy, but your property is only worth $100,000, and that's the most you're going to get. And obviously, the legislature saw a problem with this, which is why they passed the law. It works because that agent is responsible and could, in fact, lose their ability to sell that company's product if, in fact, they do this chronically. And in that sense, it works wonderfully for a private company. But for an organization such as the Fair Plan that has no agents, is required to accept applications from any agent licensed to write, it doesn't work. There's nothing we can do against agents that chronically mess up on their applications. If we were to put them in a do not insure, do not work with pile, they would quickly learn that I don't want to do the Fair Plan, so all I have to do is this, and then they'll write me off and they won't accept applications from me, and now we're into the accessibility issue. So this was a wonderful idea, and it works great for private companies, but it does not work in the context of the Fair Plan.
Mr. Johnson, does it create a moral hazard to be able to offer that higher limit?
Well, certainly. If someone had in mind, I would like to, let's say, gain some type of profit from an insurance claim, all I have to do is insure this property for more than it's worth, and then if it burns up, look how much money I make.
And under current law, without this fix, you have to pay the limit if it's a total loss.
Either that or say no. We deny your claim and, in fact, cancel your policy as if it never existed because you lied on the application. Now enter the court case.
Representative Mullery, and then we've got Representative Loeffler and Davids.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll try Representative Goodall because I'm not going to get an answer, I guess, from your witness. Would you accept that? I'm trying to protect. Right now we're taking, if this goes through, we're taking away some of the rights of the consumer, and I understand what you're trying to achieve. I can go along with that if we put in some things to protect the consumer. Would you accept something like that the Fair Plan has a burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that that their figures are correct and not the consumer?
Representative Gazelka?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, I think that is already in place in a reasonable manner. And as I looked at this to even consider carrying it, at first I thought, I don't want to carry anything related to the Fair Plan. I didn't want to do it. But the more we talked about it, to me, it gave the consumer one more option. Because if the option was to deny the claim and then have to sue everybody to get coverage, or to have the option to negotiate and then still be able to sue the agent or fair plan or whatever. To me, that's one more option that they didn't have before. So that's why I go this way. The fair plan is, you know, created by the government. It's I trust how we do government agencies. We have plenty of oversight, and I know how they work, and I don't want to add more to this than we have to.
Representative Loeffler, Representative Davis, was your question to that point?
Yes, it was.
Representative Loeffler, would you mind if we... Okay. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems like I just walked in here, and I'm a very sensitive person. It seems like there's been a lot of insurance agent bashing here. You said something about agents enriching themselves by writing more coverage. First of all, I'm an insurance agent, okay, and we avoid the fair plan like the plague. We'd rather eat broken glass, okay? If we can stay away from it, we stay away from it. It's the insured that creates the moral hazard that wants more coverage on because he's going to torture it in 2 weeks. That's what happens. I've never heard of an agent over-insuring. Now, maybe you've run into it, but I've never heard of that, an agent over-insuring a piece of property. You know, insurance agents are premium people. I mean, you know, they're the best. So to say that, and I've heard several things here going after the agents, but the whole thing was to the point is when you're saying agents are enriching themselves by writing more coverage, I'd like to see some proof of that one.
Mr. John,
at the time that the value policy division was passed, I can cite an example from my personal experience at my previous employer. Of an agent who never wrote a policy less than $100,000. This was in 1979, mind you. There weren't a lot of $100,000 homes, and certainly not his entire book of business. And yet when they looked at his entire book of business, they could not find a single home that wasn't overinsured. So the problem was present, which would explain why the legislature took action and added this wording to 65A. But nevertheless, I don't know that we need to argue over that point. At this time, we have an issue in that the fair plan is not capable of catching every single time that a property is overinsured, which means that we're left with an all-or-nothing proposition, and that is to deny the claim and force it into litigation. We'd rather not do that. We don't think that helps our policyholders. We don't think it helps the agent because they're going to get drawn in through the errors and omissions claim that will also be filed. And now we've got a big court case when simple negotiation could have easily reached an agreement. And in the event that the negotiation doesn't, the contract, again, does provide for resolution of that dispute. So all we're trying to do is allow ourselves and our customers to arrive at an agreement as to what the coverage should have been. If the customer is underinsured, we'll allow them to buy more coverage. In the same way that if the customer is overinsured, they will receive a refund of the extra premium that they paid. So I agree with the spirit of 6508. I just want it to be applicable and workable in the fair plan situation because unlike private companies, we have no agents and we have no control over the agents. And again, I don't think we should because as you point out, agents would prefer not to write with a fair plan in the first place. So if we become an enforcement body against them, I don't think that's going to improve agents' willingness to write coverage through the fair plan. And now we'll have the problem of how do insureds get the coverage they have to have just to have a mortgage.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And perhaps this is to Mr. Johnson. Just struggling to kind of understand sort of the consumer risks and viewpoint here because I assume that the Fair Plan's existence is to protect consumers' access to the market. But it feels like we're sort of... Instead of protecting the consumer and to solve a problem with the agents, we're having the consumer suffer the loss because you haven't found a way to get to the agent. And I'm thinking about the situation, and I think most people are good and ethical, but we all know in all professions there's people who have different levels of that. And we've seen a lot of mortgage flipping and other issues happening in our area. So you have somebody who buys their first house, they're at $175,000, that's what the real estate agents say, that's what the mortgage people authorize, and they insure it for $175,000 under the fair plan. And maybe they got into it because of some previous credit problems. I'm not sure quite how you get into the fair plan. And then there's a total loss. And all of a sudden, someone comes out, from the FAIR plan who covers their policy and says, but, you know, this house really is only worth $150,000. You know, they paid too much, we're sorry, but we're only going to pay $150,000. Well, all of a sudden that person still got that mortgage that's maybe $165,000 and they've got a $15,000 gap. Under the current law, you know, you're required to have insurance up to your mortgage, and you assume that the appraisers and everybody else are being honest and ethical. Are we in a situation where we could end up with consumers who have sort of been required to take out insurance at a certain level, which is what they paid, you know, for the property, who now are going to be left with a mortgage obligation greater than what their insurance will pay out?
And Mr. Johnson, while you think about your answer, I'd like to welcome the ninth grade class from St. Louis Park High School, who are apparently very fascinated by insurance and the FAIR plan. So, welcome aboard. About 3 more minutes. Mr. Johnson.
Okay, I want to address one statement made, and that is that the law requires that you insure the value of your mortgage. Not that I'm aware of. In fact, the law states that it is illegal to insure a property for more than the value of the structures. The difficulty comes in that the mortgage company, in determining how much you can borrow from them, includes the value of the land in that computation, on the principle that even if the structure is totally destroyed, there's still a lot that remains, and it does have value. And that would be part of the what would happen. The consumer would not be left with just an outstanding mortgage balance. They would still have the land available to them. Now, the other thing I'd like to address is that we talk about the consumer suffering a loss. The only loss that they would suffer would be the amount of loss or the amount of coverage over and above the actual amount of their loss. And I doubt that anyone in this room would agree that a customer should receive a windfall as a result of a loss simply because they're carrying more insurance than their property is worth. The law already states we're not supposed to do that, and that's where some of this problem comes in, is that they'll ask for a coverage in excess of the replacement cost of the structure, which is well beyond what the insurance provided by the FAIR plan is, which is actual cash value.
Mr. Johnson, I don't think I'd characterize that, though, as the consumer suffering a loss because they've been made whole because you're still going to pay the full amount of the property value. You're just not going to pay an amount in excess of that property value.
Yes, sir. That is exactly where I was going. And that's why I was questioning the terminology of calling that a loss to the consumer. The consumer might have lost the possibility of gathering a larger settlement than the loss they suffered. Now, I don't think that's something that the legislature wants to protect. We're talking about protecting a windfall. All we're talking about is the ability to ascertain the amount of loss at the time of loss and make that our settlement amount.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, that was one of the points I was going to make is frankly, the consumer loses nothing. Even if this passes, what they get is the value of their home. Obviously, they lost their home. They get the value of the home. They just don't get the windfall that they might otherwise get. I did want to point out, Representative Davids raised it, but actually Pope John Paul and Mother Teresa are also insurance agents on the side, and they are terrific people, too. All this bill does, as I understand it, is pay the actual amount of the loss. What troubles me, not about this, but about the current situation, is that we actually almost put out an invitation for fraud. Even though all of the agents, including Pope John Paul and Mother Teresa and Representative Davids, all of whom go in the same category, may be absolute in their integrity. There are some customers out there that may have less than stellar intentions and overinsure the property. The final point that I like is it actually causes an end to needless litigation. The stuff that you guys, you're left in the spot right now where if you're going to deny it, you end up in litigation. The nice thing about this is we're not going to, I'm assuming that if a property is insured for $200,000 and the value of the loss in your estimation is 197 or 193, that we're not going to litigate over that. Where we're having a trouble or a problem is where it's insured for 200 and the loss is 130, and it was clearly overinsured, and right now the options available to us are not good ones. My question, after all that long talk, was do you have any estimate as to what this saves the FAIR plan, either in terms of dollars paid? Obviously, there's a refund due to the homeowner if they've overinsured, and I appreciate the amendment. But dollars saved either in windfalls paid or secondarily in the amount of administration and other costs that would go along with the current situation.
Mr. Garrett, the administrative costs really would not change because we're not planning on changing any of our procedures to determine the correct amount of coverage. We will continue all those procedures, so I don't see it having a great difference in our administrative costs. Potentially, it could save the FAIR plan money in the event of a settlement, but it's important for everyone to realize that the total losses are a very small fraction of what we deal with in terms of claims. Maybe only 1% of our losses are actual total losses, at which time this would come into play. On any partial loss, it really would not have an effect. The contract wording says we owe the actual cash value of the loss that's been suffered. So I really have a difficult time trying to give you a number with any sort of accuracy, because it would require, first of all, the event that a total loss would take place, and then it would require knowing how much overinsured the property actually is before I could tell you how much we would save by being able to do this. I'm not looking at this as a cost savings for the FAIR plan. That's not my point. What I'm looking at is that we are currently in a situation where the person who gets penalized in a dispute over loss is the policyholder. They're the people that get penalized. They're the ones that sit without a settlement because we look at it and say, I'm sorry, we can't do that. It's against public policy. We can't reward you for what's happened. So here's the policyholder, and they're forced to sue us and sue their agent. And that's the only way they're going to get some type of satisfaction out of the situation. And that's what I'm trying to avoid. I'm just trying, hopefully, to create an alternative to that whereby we can ascertain what the amount is through negotiation and arrive at a settlement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, I've got Representative Vanderveer, then Representative Rukavina. I have questions on this very small bill, and then we'll get to the more interesting one for the children. Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gazoffit, did I hear you say that we can trust state agencies to do what is right?
He hasn't been around long.
That was proper oversight. Right, was the end of my sentence.
That's not the premise you're asking us to approve this bill under, is it?
Representative Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vanderveer, no.
Representative Gazelka, I do have another question. And you might have covered this before I got here, I'm sorry if I was late. Why should the legislature do this for the FAIR plan, but not for all plans, if it's such a good idea?
Representative Gazelka.
You did, Mr. Chair, Representative Vanderveer, you missed the beginning where I talked about the history of the FAIR plan being created by the legislature as kind of a last stop measure for people that can't get insurance elsewhere. Regular insurance has replacement costs. This is actual cash value. It's not the same.
Thank you.
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was hoping that one of our good attorney friends would still be here, but I guess Representative Liebling's an attorney too, and Atkins and Cole left the room, but we got Mullery and Liebling. But you know, I've been in the legislature now 19 years, and it seems I get a lot of phone calls every year when somebody's house are either burns down or completely or partially, say my insurance company is arguing with me over what my coverage is. I've never seen an insurance company in my 19 years pay anybody more than what's in their policy. I think most people in their house, and I don't know what it has to do with this piece of legislation, I'm just listening to my insurance agent friend over here, the Pope, Mother Teresa, a little bigger than Mother Teresa, but But, you know, I guess I just want to emphasize that most of the time that you're fighting with your insurance company because they won't give you anywhere near what you thought you had your house or your contents insured for. So now I see my trusted attorney advisor is back. So I guess I could ask him, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, when's the last time one of your clients came to you after their house burned down or partially burned down and said, my insurance company's paying me way too much money here, you know.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Representative Rucarina, when I represent them, they always get way too much.
Yeah, right. Therein lies the problem. That's a subject for another bill. Representative Rucarina.
Mr. Chair, in this case, though, and as much as I admit it at this table, I would trust my attorney to do what's right before I trust the insurance company or the state to do what is right for and my constituents, at least in a fire and insurance claim.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just noticed that I don't know if he's trying to influence me, but one of the lobbyists on this bill went to high school with me, but now he brought in one in a uniform from my high school, so I don't know what's going on there. I just wanted to comment on a couple things. Representative Atkins is a personal injury attorney. And, some of us are dirt attorneys that actually do these kind of lawsuits, and the consumer is losing something on this. And Tom is actually, or Representative Rukavina is actually, hits the nail on the head. You constantly get into issues about coverage on the partial loss. Now you're going to throw the consumer into the same problem on a total loss, whereas the law as it is not that. And that's why I'm not against trying to achieve what he says is a wrong, but I want to protect the consumer at the same time, and that could have been done if they would have accepted an amendment on the burden of proof. But
Representative Mullery, how does the consumer lose on this?
Because right now they don't have any burden of proof. They collect. They don't have to do anything. They collect. Under this bill, it's going to shift responsibility. Consumers going to have to do a lot of things that they don't have to do now, and that's why I wanted to put the burden of proof strongly on the company. So that we're not. I'm looking at trying to protect the consumer, because the same thing that Representative Rukavina is complaining about will be happening now on total losses.
Representative Dizel.
Mr. Chair, I'll just state too that as the author, it's not my intent to nickel and dime the consumer, but rather to create that third option where if we're going to deny the claim, rather than the Fair Plan denying the claim, we have an opportunity to negotiate the loss. Rather than take them to court. So that's why I think it is consumer friendly, and part of the reason I didn't want to go towards somehow trying to penalize the agent to get them more involved is because most agents don't want to do this anyway, and secondly, it doesn't require an agent. The consumer can do this on their own, I believe. Is that correct? And so, you know, so how do you monitor those cases as well when the consumer can just do it inappropriately? And so that's why I handled it the way I did.
Okay, Representative Mullery, maybe you and Representative Gazelka can work that out on the side between now and the floor, if you can come to some agreement so we can get to the other bills.
Yeah, because otherwise this is going to be an issue on the floor for sure.
I understand. Any more necessary questions so we can get to the next bill? Representative Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say that, okay, I don't do these kind of cases really either, Representative Mullery, but I don't really see where the consumer problem is in this, frankly. But I just want to ask a question and maybe clarify some of that. I assume that in other law, the burden of proof is set out for what the plans for an approved say that you're under current law. When you want to say this is overinsured and we're not going to pay, you have a burden of proof that you have to meet there, correct? And is that, where would that be set out?
I don't understand that option is available to us at all under 65A08. I don't see that we have the right. If we chose to deny it for misrepresentation, then of course the burden would be on us to prove that misrepresentation took place. The standard that I understand the courts follow is that the people that write the contracts, in other words ourselves, have the burden, and whenever something's ambiguous, it is ruled against us, as it should be. We wrote the contract. So I understand that we already have the burden of proof to show that what we do is accurate and fair. But I don't think we even have the ability, short of denying the claim outright, to argue the amount of loss. That was the whole purpose of 65A08 in the first place.
Okay.
Representative Liebler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're saying is it's not in statute, it's just a regular, this is just the regular burden that exists under case law, I assume. And this bill really doesn't change that at all.
No, nor do we intend it to.
Okay, thank you.
That's not what we're asking.
Okay, that being it, Representative Gazelka renews this motion that House File 667, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Holberg, I believe, is on the way. In the meantime, we have the minutes passed out.
Almost as a partial.
So if the page would pass out the minutes, that would be great. Representative Severson, having just thoroughly read the minutes, moves the adoption of the minutes for February 23rd.
Having thoroughly read them, Mr. Chair, February 23rd, I move that the minutes be approved.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Okay. Representative Loeffler, you want to go since we're waiting for Representative Holberg? Representative Loeffler moves House File 933 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Loeffler, to your bill.
Mr. Chairman, after hearing the bill, you may want to reconsider and consider the consent calendar. Thank you, members of the committee. This bill was brought by the Department of Public Safety, and for a bill that is almost exclusively numbers, it is one of the few that doesn't spend any money. And basically, all it does is take one section of statutes in Chapter 158 and move it over to Chapter 53. And the reason for that is the all the statutes that are listed here deal with installment sales of motor vehicles. So instead of paying cash full price when you buy a car, you buy it on the time plan. And the statutes that regulate those auto installment laws are right now in the Department of Public Safety section of laws, which deal with license plates and tabs and all the things that we do to regulate motor vehicles. But the enforcement authority for these types of loans is within the Department of Commerce. And what this bill would do is simply take those loan-related statutes and put them in the Department of Commerce chapter, which seems to be a more appropriate area in partnership with the other loan regulations of the state. Our ever attentive and astute counsel for the committee, Mr. Tom Pender, indicated to me it may actually have a savings, and that this means that some of the Department of Commerce staff would only have to have one volume of the statutes instead of two to do their work. And with that, I would be glad to answer any questions.
Questions from members? Representative Zellers.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Loeffler. Could you actually estimate a page number that we would be saving then if we're not going to print that second volume?
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Zeller, since I'm not aware of how many Department of Commerce employees actually would use the only one volume of the statutes, first is getting the status of having them all on their desk or in their office. I couldn't estimate that, but I'm sure if you wanted to request a fiscal note, there might be some consideration about the cost of that process as well.
Additional questions, comments? Is it? Representative Loeffler, then we'll just move it out. Representative Loeffler moves or renews her motion that House File 933 be recommended passed and be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Let's fall off. Representative Rukavina?
I think Representative Loeffler asked for it to be put on a consent calendar.
That's right. I'm sorry. are there any objections to this going to consent? Seeing none, we'll revise that motion that it go to the consent calendar. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in honor of what I understand is a tradition that freshmen, when they first present a bill in a committee in which they serve, bring treats, I have brought a treat that is actually more substantial than the bill, and if the page could help me disperse those, that would be great.
That's always in order. especially on days when the chairman didn't get lunch. Representative Holberg. The chair moves House File 1230 be recommended to pass and referred to civil law. Is that correct, Representative Holberg?
That is, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Please explain your bill.
Mr. Chair, basically my bill deals with the publishing of cell phone numbers for directories. That's something that there's been some attention to at the federal level. And Mr. Neumeister contacted me this fall about working on a bill to align Minnesota statutes with the new federal standards. He's here to testify on the bill. And also, I had a meeting this morning with some representatives of the cell phone industry. Given your efficiencies and that the bill was just introduced on Thursday and the committee hearing was scheduled so quickly, they're going to come and testify against my bill. We haven't worked out some of their concerns, so it will be the pleasure of the committee if you want to move it without recommendation to regulated industries or hold it here. But I have spoken with them about being willing to make some changes to the bill to address some of their concerns as well. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Neumeister, please introduce yourself.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you and to support this bill. Minnesota should act to safeguard privacy and to create enforceable rights with respect to our data, your data, particularly when you have cell phones, as it relates to wireless communication. These directories raise risk of privacy, telemarketing calls, faxes, etc., including spam. And if you take a look at the language, it's not with cell phones. It's also with text messaging and other kinds of new technologies that at least we see on the horizon. To safeguard privacy, as new technologies emerge, Minnesota has always been in the forefront of those kinds of things. We can just go down some of the numbers or the bills and laws. One, dealing with lie detectors, which covers voice stress analyzers. In terms of some of the things dealing with wiretaps and electronic communication back in the mid-80s. Recently, as 3 years ago, I was working with Representative Pawlenty on being the first state in the union to have an internet privacy bill. The concept is you get legislation out there, and then the new technologies can fit in with the interest of your constituents and consumers of Minnesota here in mind. And what the bill does, and I'm not familiar yet with what the folks who wish to testify about on the other side are trying to do, but at least what we're trying to do is to make sure data collection is fair, open, and subject to law, that there be consumer confidence knowing in some of the private information that they have, particularly with phone numbers, and that the privacy interests that are promised by the wireless communication folks, rather than by law, but who can change at almost any time. We have examples of this over the years. eBay, Amazon, Yahoo are some of the folks who say up front in their contract or whatever it may be, hey, this is a promise, but then they renege on their promises to you based upon, because there's a demand to maybe give more marketing information to you or to sell maybe some of the what you buy off certain things or what kind of books you might get. So what the bill does, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, set out a structure based on a law that was passed in California. The premise of it is, and Arnold Schwarzenegger signed it, and it's been law for about 6 or 7 months now. In other states, some of the other states are starting to introduce these kinds of legislation all across the country. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my comments.
Any questions from members? Representative Yaros.
Mr. Chairman, that's lobby. I mean, he doesn't get paid. I was a lobbyist at one time. I got paid a little bit, but this guy works for free.
That's a good point.
Anyway, but Richard, Neumeister, I'm sorry.
I've been here so long. He doesn't know my last name. It's just the first name.
It's just you're always well known by Richard.
Would a cell phone abuser while driving a vehicle and getting an accident his identity could not be revealed under this bill, so that the law enforcement could not punish or charge that individual? Is that what you're trying to, part of the reason of this bill, or what?
No,
I'm sure it's not the reason of that bill. No.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Yaros, it's related in terms of the subject, but in terms of that situation, no. Because the law enforcement, in doing its investigation, whether or not, let's say, for example, they found out in discussing that the gentleman was, or the lady, was on the telephone with the accident, as part of their investigation, they would be able to get under current law, get access to those records or whatever under 626A, which is privacy of communication. So folks, they would be able to get that information already. That's already law.
Representative Rubina.
To this point, I think I can clarify that for Representative Jarvis. They still would be able to nail you, and they'd still be able to, you know, have you have to hire an attorney. They just wouldn't be able to give your cell phone number and name to the Minnesota Peace Officers Association so they could call you at home for a contribution. That's what this bill does.
Thanks for the clarification. Other questions for the witness?
Am I right?
Seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Neumeister. There's some other testifiers that would like to testify to the bill. Victor Dobras and Joe Bagnoli. Mr. Murphy, you want to come down too, I guess. It's fine. More of the merrier, absolutely.
They're certainly.
I doubt it. Please introduce yourselves for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Victor Dobras, representing Sprint. First of all, Sprint believes that the bill is unnecessary. No one is currently offering wireless directory assistance. It's been discussed. It was discussed at the national level. Sprint favors wireless directory assistance because a good number of our customers who use their wireless telephones either as their sole telephone service or for their business have indicated to us that they would like to be included in a directory. Now, that said, we've taken a very strong position in our testimony at the U.S. Senate, and I have a copy of the letter here from our chairman to John McCain on the Senate Commerce Committee for distribution to the members. But we've taken a very strong position that customer name, telephone number, and other personal information is customer proprietary information, that we will not include customers in any wireless directory without that customer's consent, that we will not charge to remain unlisted in any wireless directory, that we will not charge a customer to have his name, his or her name removed from a wireless directory at such time as we choose to offer one. We do have some technical issues with the particular bill that's in front of the committee in terms of the requirement to send an annual notice to existing customers, asking them once again whether or not they wish to be included in the directory, and with the provisions regarding forwarding of calls that are from another party to directory assistance that we cannot technically comply with. And we'd be interested in working with the author to resolve some of those concerns if this bill goes forward. But with that, I reiterate, the bill is, in our view, unnecessary, but we certainly have every intention of protecting customer information. And that concludes my remarks. I'll stand for questions if any.
Questions of this? Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does the, under your current promise of privacy, and you state that you asked the customer for the for their permission to put it in the directory, is that what you just said, or do you send them a note that unless they send something back, they're going to be in the directory?
Mr. Dobrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vanderveer, we do not currently offer directory assistance for wireless customers and have not collected any authorizations from customers at this time. At such time as we do, the expectation is that we will require them to affirmatively opt in to being included in the directory assistance database.
And Mr. Chair, as we know you don't do with your contracts, will you keep some record to prove that they agreed to opt in, or would this just be one of those "what we called you and you said" kind of deals?
Mr. Dobrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vanderveer, we expect to keep records.
Representative Vanderveer. What changed to have you start doing that?
Mr. Dobrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vanderveer, the wireless directory assistance issue is a new issue. It's a politically sensitive one because of concerns about consumer privacy, and we will take appropriate precautions.
Well, Representative Polberg, if you can get agreement with these guys, you're going to get a medal, because I think what they want the bill to say is that we get to do whatever we want to whoever we want, whenever we want, all the time. And then you'll get agreement. But good luck.
Mr. Chairman, Tom, Representative Murphy, Singular.
Please.
Representative Vanderveer, Singular also does not currently have a directory. And it is certainly our intention to have an opt-out, opt-in policy that is second to none. So we have a commitment to work with Representative Polberg on this, and I hope we can come to some sort of agreement.
Representative Vanderveer.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I have a constituent that would beg to differ with you who's now got a bad credit rating, but we could discuss that later.
Representative Goodwin and Representative Mull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, does anybody have a wireless directory at this time?
Gentlemen, whoever wants to take that, Mr. Dobrath.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, to the best of my knowledge, no one has a wireless directory assistance service today.
Then,
Representative
Mr.
Goodwin.
Chair, I see this bill as kind of allowing a wireless directory and only prohibiting the use of people's names who don't opt in to have their names used in that directory. It kind of looks to me like we're pushing something that isn't even there, and just making just little exclusions for that. What's happening at the federal level? Are they? Is it possible with federal law to have wireless directories right now to even do that? Is federal law prohibit them? Is what I want to ask you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, my understanding is that federal law permits them.
Permits them.
But okay. That when they were discussed over the last year or so, they remain controversial enough that no one has yet implemented a wireless directory assistance service.
Well, Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think we should just go ahead and prohibit wireless directories, quite frankly, and it'll solve a lot of problems. And if people want to have their name in a directory, they can get a landline.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
I feel compelled to say that the reason Singular is looking into this issue is because, there, believe it or not, there is a strong demand for a wireless directory. And by and large, it's from independent business people, realtors, for example, other folks that are on the road and aren't in their office, you know, from day to day. I'm not in my office very much these days. I wouldn't want my name in the directory, so I would opt out. I wouldn't opt in, because there is no opt out. However, Singular will provide an opt out if you opt in and you don't like it and it isn't working out for you. You'd be able to opt out, no charge. So there is, it's hard to believe, but there is a demand for a wireless directory amongst a certain sector of the population.
Representative Goodwin, the 20-somethings don't have anything attached to walls anymore.
I know that.
Representative Moe?
But they'd have to if they wanted their new director.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My understanding, looking at this bill, is that you have no problem with the wireless directory idea, that people have to opt in for it. That's effectively what you'd like to do now, correct?
Mr. Dobris?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's effectively correct.
Now,
Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Not to say that there are any unscrupulous cell phone providers out there, but let's just hypothetically say that there might be some out there that aren't as ethical as Sprint is, that they might be willing to let some of our cell phone numbers out of the bag. This might prohibit them from being as ethical as you are now. If we worked with this bill, maybe change the language to a couple of the concerns you have, legally put in place an opt-in policy. There's a lot of us, like myself, I don't want telemarketers calling me on my cell phone. I mean, I just don't want it. You know, and I want to make sure that, and I know a lot of our constituents wouldn't either. I mean, the minutes run up fast enough as it is. So would you be open to this bill if, in fact, a couple of your concerns were worked out?
Mr. Dobris.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we would still prefer to have the issue dealt with at the federal level so we don't deal with 50 separate state sets of rules and requirements.
Okay.
But as I indicated, we're willing to work with the author to address some of our concerns.
Yeah.
Representative Moe?
Would the author be interested in working on the bill to address the concerns with keeping in place the opt-in clause, which is the primary, as I understand it, the primary reason for the bill?
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Moe, as I said in my opening remarks, this bill was introduced on Thursday, scheduled for a hearing late on Friday for today. I just met with these gentlemen this morning, and certainly I'm willing to work with them on their concerns. I do view the opt-in provision as an important component of the bill that we probably have to get into some kind of wrestling match over to make changes to that. But other than that, you know, notification, timelines, those kinds of things. And I understand their concern about not wanting to have to address 50 different standards across the country and their preference for a federal standard. But I think we in the state can still put some basic guidelines into our state law to make sure that at least those basic guidelines are adhered to.
I'm a freshman down here 2 months, so how to proceed with this? I mean, I think there's a good idea here, but the Sprint and Singular have a couple of concerns that are legitimate. How would you recommend we proceed?
Representative Moe, this bill has, I would say, two more stops, civil law and regulated industries, I guess. There will be plenty of time for Representative Holbrook to work any issues out if they're workable with the industry. Representative Rukavina, then we'll go back to Representative Goodwin.
Well, sure, I think, you know, Representative Holbury has a good bill, and her and I many times are...
That's on tape.
On the... Her and I are sometimes on the opposite end of issues, but on data privacy issues, we're both libertarians to a degree, and I'm just a progressive libertarian. She's a, you know, conservative one. I'm amazed that... I don't think the bill is actually strong enough, and I hope you hold to your guns as this bill progresses. But what I want to ask Representative Holbrook is, you know, Representative Holbrook, I have bills numbered 46 and 52 and 88 in this committee, and I can't get a hearing. And you're here with a bill that just got a number last... Was it Monday or Thursday?
Representative Holbrook, how did you do that?
Thursday. Mr. Chair, I'm as surprised as Representative Rukavina is about it, as I was rushing around the last 2 days trying to get ready for this. But and also, given the fact that I'm not hearing any local projects in transportation finance, so it can't be that either. So.
Well, it must be that things were so slow in this committee that we needed, you know, to hear this bill, but yet we can't get a hearing on minimum wage or snowmobile lights
before it's time.
Mr. Chair, I can tell you that Chair Westrom is dying to hear this bill, though he has been asking me about it for a number of weeks, so that may have fed into this.
And Representative Rukavina, I do have to talk to you after committee about one of your other bills, one of the departments, so we can deal with at least one of them.
Oh. Kids serving liquor.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is that Representative Sieben has a real early number bill that does basically the same thing as this that was introduced long before Representative Holberg's bill, and I believe that was in front of this committee as well. Why haven't we heard Representative Sieben's bill? I believe it's real early in the numbers, like 4 or 5 or something similar.
Representative Goodwin, I'm not sure if that's... It might be in our committee. I'd have to look at the list, but it struck me that that might have been referred to in one of the other committees that this one's going to. I could be mistaken on that. I just don't have the list of our bills in front of me.
Well, Mr. Chair, what was the rush on this bill into this committee when it was introduced so early?
It just fit in. We had two bills on the schedule, and we thought we could fit in another one in pretty quick.
I see.
Mr. Chair, and if I might...
Got bills on this side, too, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevens' bill went straight to regulated industries.
Pardon?
Representative Stevens' bill went straight to regulated industries.
Okay.
Is my understanding.
Yeah, that's why we don't have it here. Okay, Mr. Bagnoli, you've been trying to...
Mr. Chair, Joe Bagnoli, I just wanted to clarify, on the sheet it says I'm here with Sprint. I'm actually here with Nextel. Nextel and Sprint, as some of you may know, are going through a merger, but for the time being, we're just pre-merger. We have... So we're close, but not quite. I just wanted to just express all of what's been expressed before is pretty much where Nextel is. We've had a nice meeting with Representative Holbrook this morning, and I think I'm more than happy to work out some of the issues that have been discussed with her, and I think that we'll be able to do so in a way that meets many of the concerns that have been expressed here today.
Any further questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Holbrook, the chair renews his motion that House File 1230 be recommended to pass and re-referred to civil law. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
And we... What's that? Yeah. Yeah, we did. We're adjourned.